Hello and welcome to the Dream Swarm podcast. This is your home for supernatural film, stories and art. I'm your host, magic realist filmmaker Andy Mark Simpson. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. I'm really pleased today to be welcoming the authors of The Red Man and Others, Angeline D. Adams and Renko Van Straten. So welcome to this episode of Dream Swarm.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
I've got you two on because you've got a new collection of short stories out called The Red Man and Others, which we're going to get onto in a moment. Would you just briefly introduce the audience to yourselves?
Well, I grew up in Northern Ireland and I started my career as a freelance arts journalist, but I've always had half-written novels in a drawer, lots and lots of short story ideas, and eventually I felt the pull of turning them into something. And I'm autistic and I'm very, very passionate about disability rights stuff, so that's also found its way into my work, including my fantasy work as well.
I'm Remco and I'm from the north of the Netherlands, and during my student days I slowly drifted westwards. About 15 years ago I moved over to Belfast. Well, since then I have been with Angeline. We were doing arts journalism, but after a while, having interviewed writers and actors and written reviews about movie, theater, books, we thought, like, you know, we've spoken with other people. Now we want to focus on our own work. So we started writing the stories that we wanted to tell. That's how The Red Man and Others came rolling out eventually.
You've kind of got that history of absorbing all this creativity and this artwork and things whilst, you know, having that urge to write yourselves, and then that's come out in this collection of short stories. Would you be able to tell us about The Red Man and Others and what people can expect from that?
Yeah, well, The Red Man and Others, it's a collection of stories about a found family of con artists. Kayla is a small but tough sellsword, and she has reluctantly acquired a protege, and she's unexpectedly acquired a girlfriend. So the protege is Sebastian. He's a teenage thief with a very flexible conscience, and Kayla's girlfriend Imka is a disabled farm girl turned scribe turned forger. So each of these characters has got their own grudge against a fundamentalist cult who are called the Brotherhood of the Wheel. And Sebastian just happens to resemble the saint who is venerated by the cult. So that gives them an opportunity for revenge and to make a bit of money as well. But when the trio bring the uncomplaining child back to life, it's got some unforeseen effects on both the town and our heroes.
It's a collection. It has three main stories and then a bunch of smaller
flash fiction.
Yeah. And at first, the stories that we wrote, they were unconnected. But then we started to see possibilities to link them. And actually, you know, there was no plan behind it. We had written The Red Man, that is Imka's backstory. Then for the third story, The Return of the Uncomplaining Child, we needed a scribe. And we thought, like, well, you know, we can just pick Imka there and plop her in this story. And so they connected. And once we started doing that, more connections became clear to us and more possibilities suggested themselves. We're both from a background with a lot of religious turmoil. That almost naturally became a background to these stories. It gave us a way of exploring how societies work and what it means for outsiders to fall into that. Yeah, what it means for people to have to survive within that.
I was reading it in the kind of three main stories in there, which, as you say, the order of them is quite interesting. In that the first two don't seem connected, but then the third one kind of ties it all together and sends it on a new adventure. But it gives the impression of a whole world that you've created there. So even though they're quite short stories and they're very contained, there's a lot of hints of a wider world in there, especially when you connect the three stories together. You see this kind of wider kind of landscape of the farming and the wars, that religious turmoil, as you say. Speaking of the religion, because that is a strong theme, I felt, is a critique of organized religion, but not necessarily the harshest critique of it. I think it's kind of lampooned in a way and it's criticized, but then you've also got some of the benefits and some of the people who go in with the right motivations into that as well.
Yeah, I think where that came from for me is that I've sort of seen it from both sides, and that I grew up a very devout Christian and then later on I became an atheist. So on the one hand, I've seen a lot of things that can go wrong around churches where people's religion becomes a motivation or at least an excuse for them to harm each other. But on the other hand, And I can also see the value of faith. I mean, I still live in the same place I always have. So I'm, you know, I have friends who are religious. I'm around a whole sort of range of people's very different responses to religion and to not having a faith. And I think this all happened really organically as well. I mean, on the one hand, whenever we were creating Imca's World, you know, in the war-torn north, on the one hand, that calls back very strongly to where Remco grew up. But the stuff later on in The Return of the Uncomplaining Child, where it is more about that very specific, very harsh fundamentalist view of religion. When we were writing that, I don't think that I actually considered how much it was drawing on my own experience. And it's only later on, whenever we returned to the stories, when we were re-editing them to publish, that I thought, actually, you know, there's a lot of stuff has just naturally... I mean, I don't want to say it was all unconscious, because obviously once we got into those themes, we did start thinking, you know, what are we showing here? What are we implying? But it's really interesting to me that stuff from your background will always find a way to come out in your fiction.
I guess that's true of all writers, but it did seem in your books, there's the bits at the end that I read where you could explain some of the influences and things, and I can really see how that came up, both in the geography of it and in the kind of the history, so linking to the religious things, and but also the kind of war-torn history of the areas. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about that? It's something that I'm just interested in. I'm from Northumberland, which is kind of between England and Scotland, and it's always been war-torn in wars between those two states and within itself. And I found that interesting, the way you expanded on that at the end of the stories. Would you be able to give us a few more details about how that has influenced you, that kind of landscape and history?
Sure. Well, the north of the Netherlands, Groningen, where I'm from, it's a place where people go to relax. It's a very flat landscape. It's very quiet over there, but it's quite close to the sea, so it would have a strategic position in the earlier seafaring days. That meant that whenever there was war, that there was always armies would come there. And no matter what army came, it was, you know, the little people who would almost always suffer under it. Aside from that, the people in the north are also very stubborn, and they can be quite touchy as well. And in medieval times, we had a civil war, which was not really centered on big groups, but it was neighbor against neighbor, family against family. And whichever side you were on was depending on loyalties, people falling out with each other. So it was a very confusing time. Everyone was at war with each other. There were a lot of small, well, I can hardly call it castles.
Sort of almost like fortified manor houses.
Yeah, fortified towers. It was a mess. And nowadays you can see very little back of that, but you know, it's got a very bloody history over there.
A big influence on that history of where you grew up and kind of drawn from that, and as well in Northern Ireland. What other influences did you have? You describe it as sword and sorcery. There's very limited magic in these stories, but I know you're saying in you're kind of expanding that world to find where the magic is in that, but you say it's in the sword and sorcery genre. So what other influences did you have that fed into that writing?
Yeah, for me, it all started with Robert E. Howard. I read his first stories when I was about 15 years old. They were very formative for me. Now, as an adult, going back to them, I read them in a different way. I still enjoy them, but it's more of his skill that I admire. For someone who was paid by the word, he is actually a very economic writer. The way he would describe a battle, for example, he has a knack for staying very close to his main characters, and yet also describe how the larger battle is going. Going to his earlier work, the King Cole stories, there you can see how the sword and sorcery genre, which he pretty much started, hadn't settled yet. So he gives himself the freedom to be more experimental. The stories get very dreamlike at times, outright funny or horror. So, you know, that's very liberating, actually.
I think we really relate to that as well, because that's the wonderful thing that happens. You see it in music as well. You know, whenever a genre is just getting started, whenever it doesn't have a name yet. And of course, sword and sorcery wasn't named as such for decades. I don't mm-hmm. example, after hard was working. So there's this moment when it's undefined and people get to just grab from all of their different influences, bring it together. And that's a sense of freedom, which perhaps later on, whenever it all crystallizes and people start saying, well, these are the rules of the genre, and people then perhaps judge your work not on its own merits, as in, what is this story doing, but based on what do I assume this story is trying to do? What do I think it should be doing because I've limited it, you know, genre-wise? And I think that for us to handle our world in the way that we have, I think it's partly just instinctive, but we wanted, you know, we do naturally lean towards humor, as in two of the stories in particular, we obviously do. But there are also moments of horror and there are moments of real tension. And I think that we would always want to keep it elastic in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we want to box ourselves into it much.
Yeah, you mentioned world building, mm-hmm. and actually we're kind of quite light on world building. Mm-hmm. We don't have a map or any big plan of how the world is set up. So it gives us the freedom to just whatever we want to do, we can find a space within it. Mm-hmm. You know, our world literally is no bigger than what our characters have experienced mm-hmm. and what they know of the world. We're allowing ourselves also to put in whatever we're interested in. So the Return of the Uncomplaining Child, we had just seen Fritz Lang's Nibelungen film, and we thought, like, oh, that would be a very nice backdrop for yeah. the story. So
the aesthetic was just gorgeous, and we just fell in love with it.
Yeah, so we plopped it in, and, you know, is it realistic? Is it logical? I don't know. But on the other hand, is our own world always logical and realistic? I, you know, if I were someone from 100 years ago and I look at hipster beards and skinny jeans and tiny purses and
Segways,
then, yeah. you know, does that make sense? You know, yeah. that's what I would say to any writer. Like, you know, if you think it's fun and you can make it work,
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, do it for the aesthetic. Just, you know, enjoy it. Don't let yourself get too constrained. I mean, because the thing is, we both read and loved a lot of books where there's an incredibly complex and developed world, where there's constructed languages, where everything is mapped out, where there's histories and genealogies. And that stuff is fantastic, but I don't think that it's the only way to do things. And I like the fact that I often say that it feels as if we are kind of rolling the world out under our characters' feet as they're walking. And we have ideas like, I mean, obviously in Robert E. Howard's world, the countries that Conan explores are roughly analogous to, you know, places from our world, to regions, to places that the Romans would have known, you know. And I like, obviously, he had more of a map than we do. You know, in our heads, the country that Imke's from is obviously congruent roughly with the north of the Netherlands, but I think that in her world it takes up a lot more space. You know, maybe her world is one where, if that world is a parallel universe to ours, maybe Doggerland was never flooded, for instance, when the ice caps melted, for example.
Yeah, because it really works in the way the stories are presented. For example, Imke, who part of her character is that she's had a very, I'm not going to say sheltered life, but a very contained life. She's grown up on the same farm, and you feel the influence of the wars around. But the kind of part of her character is that she realizes she's being in this kind of very contained small world on that farm. So I think it really works to not be presenting, he has a map of everything else, or he has a narrator telling you the whole history and backstory of every kingdom in the area, because we're seeing it through Imke's eyes in the Red Man story. So it's good to kind of get a feel for that without giving the audience all the background, you know, make them discover it, as you say, as Imke discovers it, and leading into the third story, how that links to the wider world.
Yeah, but even so, we also like to drop in little bits of, you know, there's a couple of songs in there, for example, little stories she reads from a book. So, you know, we do yeah. like to drop bits of culture in just to give it texture.
We love making up folklore. You know, we like the fact that it's got that sense of sort of deep time, that those people have been living on that land for a long time. And so there are these little legends. They do have these annual traditions, and, you know, we see them celebrate.
They have rituals around the harvest, don't they? And yeah. that feels really authentic, you know, not necessarily real to our world, but it feels like a realistic harvest ritual that you would do in that kingdom.
Well, that's where our own love for folklore and history comes into play as well.
Very, very much so, yeah. In a funny sort of way, we both have connections with living history museums. I didn't know my dad, he died before I was born, but he worked at our local folk museum. And so I have grown up visiting it all the time and hearing about all the agricultural traditions and what it was like here going back hundreds of years. And Remco actually used to work at his local living history museum, which is actually one of those fortified houses that we talked about before. So this place is medieval, it's got a moat around it, there's a farm next to it, and it makes the past very alive. I think that if you look at those two museums, it really makes sense that we're writing the kind of stuff that we are and that we do feel so driven to make folklore a big part of it.
That's been something that has been part of your inspirations for a long time, is that folklore. That really does come across in the stories there. There's a sense of the kind of culture of the area and the rituals and the kind of traditions and the work and the everyday of the area as well. So that's really good. Could we talk a bit about the representation of disability and sexuality? I think the stories are really inclusive, but it comes across in such a naturalistic way, and obviously there's no reason why it shouldn't, but you know, you get so many people these days resisting inclusivity in storytelling and in folklore and in fantasy novels, and saying, you know, it's lip service or it doesn't feel natural. But you know, there's no reason why it shouldn't feel natural, but I think the way you represent disabilities and sexuality just feels really natural in it. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That has just been a really important thing for us, because you know, we're not living in a world where everybody is like a white, straight, non-disabled man. I think on a really fundamental level, we didn't want to write about a world where our friends couldn't exist, where we couldn't exist, and the disability thing in particular. Like, I think that whenever people look at disability in fiction, I think that very often people assume that it's a symbol in some way. They look at a character being disabled and they think, like in Imka's case, people might perhaps read that as, oh, her disability is a metaphor for the fact that she is so limited, because as you say, she's lived this incredibly contained life. In many ways, Imka is somebody who, she has mastered the art of only becoming like as big a person as her circumstances will support. Her father has raised her in exile for reasons of his own. She's been discouraged from mixing with people, even just, you know, with neighbors in the local countryside. And it's only really when the red man comes into her life, and this is a wounded warrior who her father has dragged home from the battlefield, that is the point where I think, as often happens to us in life, sometimes it takes someone else to come into our life and ask questions about it. And he asks her about her disability, and he asks her, you know, don't you want anything more in life? And I think that that sows the seed also of her questioning more and questioning her father more. And you know, her disability is something that, although it's not one that I share, it is very much drawing on Remco's mother's experiences. And for me, what I do have in common with Imka is, you know, having lived with chronic pain, having lived with questions about, is my disability going to grow worse as I get older? What's going to happen whenever I can't physically do the things that I need to do now? And those are very big questions that I think a lot of us have. And, you know, a way that we differ is that, like, people who meet Imka know that she's disabled. You know, it's recognizable. You know, she limps. Sometimes she's visibly in pain. My disabilities, I have Crohn's disease, and I have some other sort of rarer and more complex digestive conditions. I'm also autistic. So for the most part, people don't necessarily know unless I tell them, but the very fact that it's so hidden becomes a problem in itself. And I think that that's also why the fact that I've been involved in disability rights activism, I think that has kind of driven me in fiction also to want to make this visible, because people, as you say, people very often respond to diversity in books by saying, oh, it's tokenistic, or you're just doing it to be politically correct. And it's like, no, because 15% of people in the world are disabled. So in the average workplace, you'll have disabled colleagues. You may not realize they have a disability, but, you know, they're there. And so, I mean, on a very basic level, they should be there in fictional worlds as well.
As far as their sexuality is concerned, I think it's really secondary to the plot, to the stories. Mm. It's there, but we don't want it to become a gay book.
It's like, we also don't feel like we have the authority to say, you know, we can't write definitively and say, well, this is a lesbian experience or this is a bisexual experience, but we also don't want, it just kind of happened naturally that we felt, you know, those two would fall for each other. And then we already knew that we wanted to have a diverse world and diverse characters. And so we just leaned into it. It just happened so organically. And we were happy that that happened because friends have so often told us like how left out they feel whenever they read stuff where, oh, everyone is straight and that's not like real life. Or, you know, where you get just one character who is gay or one character who is disabled. Whereas in practice, and this is something we also want to expand on in future stories, all of us, we gravitate to each other. You know, minorities, we quite naturally, we find each other and we draw strength from each other. You see that with Kayla and Master Osgot, for example, in the first story. And that's something that, I mean, why wouldn't you represent that if you have the opportunity?
Well, like you were saying as well, it's not presenting disability as, you know, might see another fantasy fiction as a representation of their character. You used to get all these evil people in wheelchairs, didn't you, and some of the things in the bad old days. But and as I say, it's not necessarily part of the plot. It's just something that they have, and it discusses it. But it's not a sudden thing. It's not like a tragic accident. It's not becoming newly disabled. It's not part of the plot necessarily. It's just part of the characterization of those characters in a naturalistic way that they just live their lives.
Yeah, that's important for us to, you know, that, as Anthony said, that it doesn't become a metaphor for something or this is a disability book. Now, we just wanted it to be there, but for Imke to, you know, be more than her disability. Mm. And that's, you know, what we really want from any characters, I think, that they are more than the plot they are telling.
Yeah.
We've chatted about your different influences here, and obviously I've got you both on because you co-wrote this collection of stories. It's not an experience I've really had before as a writer. So what is it like writing with a writing partnership? How does it work? What are the kind of pitfalls or good points of it?
And the good point is that you always have your editor just sitting one room further on at the most. I think the only thing you really need to succeed as a writing couple is that you do need to go in with your noses pointing the same way. You need to have the same general direction. Also, it's important not to be too precious about your prose or your ideas, because, you know, Angeline might write something and I, you know, write over it, or I might come up with a joke and Angeline thinks like, and it's not great, so she might scrap it. How it in practice works is we do each have our strengths. I'm a little bit more for plotting, and Angeline is stronger on dialogue, so we take turns in our drafts and kind of like hammer out our drafts, and what ends up is something that we can look at and say like, did you write this or did I write this or who knows?
That happens so much, like especially whenever you go back to edit, as we did both when we were preparing The Red Man and Others as an ebook and then when we did the paperback, we would look at things and say, whose idea was that even? There's a lot of things where we can't remember where it came from. And I mean, I guess in theory, we do alternate drafts and we save our old drafts. And I think that's actually quite key to the whole thing, because then you can go back and see how it's evolved. There's also, I get the sense that we have developed a shared narrative voice. So on the one hand, there's definitely things where all writers have their kind of pet phrases, their pet ways of saying things. And those things are evident, like I know what mine are and I know what his are. But whenever you have the final story, I think that we've kind of written towards this shared voice. And the other thing is that it's not just about what happens on the page, because the fact that we obviously live together means that we are sitting down, you know, before we, even whenever something is just an idea and we're just kind of chatting about that, or whenever things are far advanced, like not very long ago we were talking about Sebastian and we were sort of discussing, you know, what are the limitations of the character, like what are, we were wondering particularly about his early life and how it has had a sort of harmful impact on him and his sort of moral development. And those things, you really discover then what the other person really thinks and where the points of overlap and commonality are. And luckily we have a lot of overlap. I have no doubt that there are some couples who this writing together just wouldn't work for, and that's okay. But we tend to want broadly the same things for the characters, or at least we tend to be good at, I think that we're both good at analyzing how we came to hold the views of the characters that we do. And I would say it would be quite unusual for us to have major differences on, you know, the direction. What it tends to come down to more in a story is, does this work? Is this working plot-wise? Does this scene work? Is the reader going to understand what her motivation was in doing that, and so on?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it works. Something when you discuss a situation or when you discuss a character, you make bits of puzzle fit that you had written like months ago.
Years ago even. Because these stories go back like 6 years now, I think, is the earliest one.
Yeah, and we've got a draft in our computer of a story where Sebastian does something, which, you know, it's quite horrible what he does. Mm. And we thought, like, you know, we'll find a reason why he does it. And then we were like, yeah, we'll figure it out. And then much, much later, we were having a completely different discussion. And I was like, oh, but that's why he's doing this.
You do kind of have to let it steep. It's like tea. You have to kind of give it time to develop and to develop flavor. And I think one of the things about our way of working with short stories generally is that almost certainly the more successful ones in terms of what has been commercially successful, we very often will put something down, we might leave it for a year, and then very often we've revised things specifically with a particular anthology in mind, or because our understanding of it has changed. And I think that sometimes that ability to leave something for a while has been significant. And of course, with the Red Man and others, we have now had these characters kicking around in our heads for a long time. So I think that our sense of who they are as people has only sort of deepened over time.
The links start forming as new ideas come. So you said you've got lots of backstory on these characters, then maybe bits that have fed in and other bits that you've held back from the Red Man and others collection. So what is next for you guys? What are you working on at the moment? What do you think might be in the pipeline?
Well, we do indeed. We have things that we would love to do with those three. I mean, you haven't seen Sebastian's origin story yet. You also haven't seen Kyla's. And we have thoughts about what they might get up to much later in their lives. In an ideal world, we would like to drop in on them in future decades at different times. It is a complex decision because, you know, the one bad thing about all this is it's very labor intensive. Neither of us is a fast writer, and he particularly has a day job. So we're at a point where we're having to make difficult decisions like, can we balance that in? Can we justify that investment of time? And it is what it largely depends on is the response to this book. You know, it is there an audience out there that wants more from these characters? And so we're hoping that people will vote with their wallets or their purses in that regard, and that, you know, that there is, because I would like nothing more than to write tons of stories about those three. Yeah. We do have other ideas though. I mean, and this is also what it sort of has to be juggled with.
Yeah, as Angeline says, we're not fast writer, and really we're not stuck for ideas. We're kind of like children in the candy store with only a very small copper coin in our sweaty hand. So yeah, we've got several half drafts of Kyla and Imke stories on our hard drive. That includes a couple of novellas, a handful of short stories, both prequel stories and things set in, say, 20 years from now. For the rest, we're working on some Victorian era ghost stories with a slight hint of steampunk. There's vampires too, and they're Scottish, you know.
Scottish vampires who play bagpipes.
Yes, from the rooftops, striking fear in the people's hearts with their yammering sounds.
Yes.
And one thing that we really want to do, but it might have to steep a little bit longer, is a historical novel. It's set in the north of the Netherlands around 1850. There's, in the village where I grew up, there is one man. He was a traveler, folklorist, and a writer. Also, he was a very early anti-slavery crusader, yet he is pretty much forgotten there because he also had a very sharp pen, and he was not well liked by the other villagers. So
he tended to antagonize people, and he tended to wear his politics on his sleeve. And then, as now, progressive politics are not always appreciated, to the extent that a few years ago they literally had to uncover his grave, which had been consumed by weeds and so forth. You know, he had a contemporary who was a sort of fundamentalist firebrand preacher, and well, the preacher now has a school named after him, but a few years ago, you know, our hero Martin Dawes Teinstra, they did talk of naming a road after him, but they kind of went, what was he? Oh, a failed farmer. And in that part of the country, that counts for a lot, you know. But this was somebody who, he had traveled enough that he had seen the injustice and the racism and the ways that people are evil to each other. And so he basically came home from the colonies and started agitating for change.
Well, he was a social justice warrior.
Yeah.
And also another thing that he was railing against, and that fell in line with the religious firebrands, because the religious firebrands, they were also anti-vaxxers.
That's right, even then.
And he was, well, against them as well. That didn't go down well. So I've got his books, his writing.
He wrote a lot about folklore, which I think was how you originally sort of discovered his work, wasn't it?
Yeah, but since then, the internet is a gold mine. Discovered lots more. Holland also, they have a newspaper archive online where you can really start digging and found some of the letters that he sent to the newspapers, which were really, you know, the acid is dripping from his pen. So there's lots of material to work with, but yeah, it all has to come together yet.
Yeah, it's also that problem that every historical novelist has, the problem of at what point do you stop researching, at what point, you know, at what point does it become not a pile of research but a novel?
Yeah. And where does the story start, and then like which part do you concentrate on as the beginning and end of that particular story? So well, hopefully one day we'll get your treatment of that historical figure Teinstra, we'll get your Scottish vampires, and hopefully we'll get more of the characters from The Red Man and others as well. As you say, if that'd be really good, and I've read it and I could recommend it. I thought it was a really nice read, entertaining stories, some gritty situations but good humour in there as well, some funny lines. So how can people access that collection? How can they buy it, and also how can they follow you guys on social media and things?
Well, to start with, you can find us on Twitter. I am Angeline B. Adams and he is Remco Stratton, and on there you'll find our link tree with links to buy the book. You can also follow our page on Facebook, which is Turnip Lanterns Press, and you can check out our blog at turniplanterns.wordpress.com, and in the sidebar there you'll also find our newsletter, which you can sign up for, which will let you know first all of the stuff that we are up to.
Yeah, the blog that we have in particular, it's, as far as PR exercise goes, it's not quite on brand, or maybe it is on brand, but it's a little bit of a grab bag of, well, anything we're interested in and think like, oh, I need to write a bit about that.
It's all the obscure bits of history, the folklore, it's sword and sorcery fiction, fantasy in general. It's all the things that we're passionate about and that have filtered through into our fiction. You get much more of it in detail.
Angry rants every now and then.
Angry rants, yeah, we do have the odd one of those.
Yep.
Yeah, I've read a few of the articles that you've had on Turnip Lanterns. As you say, there's good kind of material on there, and folklore in and of itself on that blog as well. So, yeah, so turniplanterns@wordpress.com, Angeline B. Adams and Remco Stratton on Twitter. And the book, The Red Man and Others, is out on Kindle and on paperback as well.
Yeah, and I would recommend getting the paper version because it does have the extra flash fic.
Lots more illustrations.
Lots more illustrations. And I like to think it's a nice book to hold in your hand and to put in a bookcase and to keep.
Yeah, it's a good artistic collection. Because did you do the drawings for it as well?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So finally, my arts degree came in handy.
Well, thanks very much for coming on, and I would recommend the collection there, Red Man and Others, to all the readers and listeners to this podcast. But thanks very much, and I hope to speak to you guys soon. I'll follow your progress.
Okay, yeah, thank you very much, and it was really nice to be on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dream Swarm podcast. I've been your host, Andy Mark Simpson. We hope you'll join us for the next one. Remember, you can subscribe to stay in touch with future episodes and follow us at the website www.dreamswarm.org or follow on Twitter and Instagram at Dreamswarm. And we look forward to joining you for more supernatural film stories and art. In the meantime, be creative, be curious, be kind. We'll see you soon.